Hi everyone, welcome to the Curve Mindset Podcast with McGinley Coaching. I'm your founder and host, Laurie McGinley. Today we're joined by Dave Lawrence. How are you, Dave?
Very well, thank you, mate. Yourself?
Well, I'm good, thank you. Can you just tell the listeners a bit background about yourself?
Yeah, so my journey in football coaching and directorship started 23 years ago, believe it or not. I first got my first coaching badge in the year 2000. Went on to get casual coaching roles and did what most people did in terms of just trying to throw themselves into any session available. Worked for Birmingham City Council, worked for Stevenage Borough Football Club as well as a community coach before finding my place at the organisation that I spent most of my career with, which was the Albion Foundation or West Bromwich Albion's community programme. So I was a community coach with them before moving on to different project management positions. Spent 4 years in the academy at West Bromwich Albion. I became head of women's and girls and head of sport in the last kind of 8-9 years. And then more recently, since 2021, I was director of football for West Bromwich Albion Women. That job ended about 8 weeks ago now. Along the way, I've done different bits of part-time jobs along the way as well to supplement some of the coaching that maybe I was missing a little bit from being a bit more in managerial and leadership positions. So I've worked for University of Wolverhampton, University of Birmingham. I've taken up positions with the FA. I'm currently a coach mentor and a coach developer, delivering the UEFA C. UEFA A licensed coach, advanced youth award, and I've got a master's degree in sports coaching. So, very much a whistle stop. Lots of experiences along the way. Some of them very positive, some of them not so positive. But that's the journey, isn't it?
Yeah, and obviously we're going to discuss the journey. You know, from 23 years of coaching, you've obviously worked in football for a long time, but also different parts of football, because in the last 23, you've probably seen different types of leadership, to different roles, to, you know, working as a head coach, to a TD, to working in the community. But what's the kind of highlight? What's the best things you've seen working in the kind of game? Is it working with the players, working with staff, seeing some highlights that are maybe from the club? Just because a lot of people are interested in the person usually, more than the coach sometimes.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult to pinpoint really a specific memory or something that made me feel better, grateful, more emotionally connected than anything else. I think just seeing people develop is something that I cherish, those moments where you see a boy, for example, that was in the academy now representing the men's first team, you know, being rumoured to be, you know, a player that's worth millions of pounds, you know, whether it's a female footballer that I've worked with now, signing for WSL clubs, same from the coaching perspective as well, you know, seeing coaches that started with me and we moved them on to level ones, level twos and so on, and now they're doing some great stuff, whether it's with West Bromwich Albion or other clubs. You know, I think, you know, people go through a period of trying to ascertain whether they are developers or whether they are performance related practitioners, and certainly I saw myself early as being a developer of people. And so when I see people, you know, achieving such great things and on the cusp of reaching their potential, that's the stuff that I really enjoy looking at. Even better if is when they reach out to you just randomly and just ask how you are. When they ask how your family is, when they pick up the phone and ask for your advice, even though you're not part of the same organisation anymore, it's really endearing to feel that you can still support them and help them, even though, as I say, we're not connected to the same badge. So, yeah, just being there to help people and then them responding to you fondly, I think is a really good memory to have.
Yeah, and I think you always see that when you've been coaching for a while. You see the smile on their face or that one piece of advice which possibly could help them getting a pro contract and or dropping out. You know, and a lot of coaches these days have a philosophy, a methodology, but I know that the majority of you, the job you've done is at West Brom. What was your role, first of all, and then coach, like maybe a kind of session plan? What do you try to work on to improve the players? Because I don't know if the players were part-time, full-time, but again, you needed to work that out. And why did you take that kind of job when, at West Brom?
Yeah, so I've worn several different hats when I was at West Brom. As I say, I started off as a community coach. We would go into schools, we would do lunchtime clubs, after-school clubs, gymnastics, you know, all that typical kind of community coaching stuff we did. And that was a really, really good experience. You know, we often talk about and think about coaching as being working with very good footballers, 16 of the best players that are available to us in a brilliant facility with great equipment and a multidisciplinary team around us. But that community coaching role was brilliant for me to understand how to support and manage players, manage behaviours, motivate, adapt, which I think is a key skill these days. And, you know, you talk about session plans are brilliant, and you know, we can spend hours upon hours creating outstanding session plans using the best software in the world. And then 10 minutes into the session, you know, someone hasn't turned up, traffic's bad, player pulls out with an injury after 20 minutes. And the best coaches are the ones that, you know, when you watch them, you don't even notice that there's a problem. Seamlessly, they can just adapt and adjust to it. So my methodology was always around almost preparing to adapt. So making sure that the session plans for the players, and I probably recall in my experiences as technical director of the RTC or Regional Talent Club for West Bromwich Albion, that's probably the one where I spent most of my time designing sessions and technical syllabuses. It was around recognising what do the players need and what do the players want, and in particular around what does that look like for a modern footballer. So 10 years ago, when I was West Bromwich Albion women's manager, we didn't really need to defend crosses. Everything was quite central to the pitch. We would try and play out from the back at times. And now there's an obsession with playing out from the back and, you know, fullbacks getting high and getting numbers on the back line. And now all of a sudden crosses are coming into the box. So we need to adapt and be contemporary with what modern day football presents to us. So obviously there's a lot of emphasis on physicality, and you know, we'd always try and make sure our technical curriculums were mapped with strength and conditioning and physical elements that were delivered by experts. But we look predominantly over the last couple of years around dealing with crosses, wide and flank play. Obviously, the basics for the foundation phase goes around 1v1s, 2v2s, passing, you know, dribbling. All the technical components that a lot of the coaches on the call will be very familiar with. I suppose the one that we did slightly differently was we looked at specific blocks around movement. I think that the tendency is to presume that movement comes in with a passing block, and we just naturally presume that the players can move into a position to receive the football. And once they've passed it, again, they move into another position. But for me, movement is a technique as much as it's a physical attribute. So we'd spend a lot of time with the players on double runs, third player runs, spinning, engaging with the ball and lateral movement stuff, runs in beyond, which I think is a part of the game that may potentially be dying a little bit. Everything seems to be into feet, and the centre midfield players will play the ball in towards the nine's feet quite a lot, but sometimes you can't beat sticking a ball in behind the back four or back five of the opposition and getting them to face their own goal, right? And you can only really do that if you've got runners that are willing to move in behind. So we spent a lot of time on movement. As I say, through the phases, it might look slightly different. So foundation phase might be movement to receive. Youth development phase could be movement to receive and cause a problem, double runs and cute, clever movements. And then the senior team, as I say, tactically, you know, runs from outside, you know, almost in lanes 1 and 5 to go and run inside of the fullbacks to 2 and 4, for example, or the other way around. So lots of overlaps in that space. So that would probably be the methodology, which is probably the one that we focused a bit more on over the last couple of years.
Yeah, because I've been watching the World Cup, you know, really from a kind of tactical point of view, but also I just love watching it from a kind of technical and breaking the skill down. And you see the goal that the Colombian player scored, touch, putting the back in the net. But also, I've seen something you said about the a lot of players play to feet. But the biggest thing I'm starting to see now, over the last maybe wee while, is dribbling. It's a big part, you know, it's not exactly taking the player on, it's actually letting the player engage and then it's moving the ball. But you see the players, you watch it too, with the in the corridor five, and the ball goes into corridor four, but the ball might just be just the wrong pace. But there was like a comment that one of the commentators made and said, oh, it's the wrong pass. And it's like, no, it was the right pass. It was just the wrong execution. Again, looking at a lot of people you watch, you from a coaching point of view, I said to my wife, I said, am I missing something here? She said, no, it was the right pass. It was just she put the ball with the outside of her foot, which she should have used the inside of her foot to run in. But the biggest thing I started to see now is also, you say crossing, you know, a lot of people are crossing the ball from the corridor four, but they're over hitting the cross, you know, so the it's always back post runs or back to middle. Is that something that you've kind of seen lately? Because you mentioned, obviously, there's a trend, there's going to be trends where you're going to see things back again, you know, like dribbling and passing and moving. Is that something you've obviously watched the World Cup? Do you think that's something we'll take on from the World Cup, not in the kind of UK game? Or do you think it's more, it's going to be one of them things of we look at it for 2-3 weeks and then we go back to the way we always wanted to play, or the way we've done it, which is the worst expression I've heard in a long, long time?
Yeah, it's really interesting, because I think that we are at risk of reacting quite a lot to changes of the game and trends of the game, and you know, I think, you know, male and female football alike, you know, Germany win the World Cup and everybody wants to play like Germany, and then Spain win the World Cup, everyone wants to play like Spain. And I think that, you know, people that would be in a similar position to mine as technical director would be, you know, what are we actually really good at? What do we stand for as a club? What do we want to look like in and out of possession? So what's our identity? And really kind of focusing in on that. If there's a team in the World Cup or in the Euros that play in that way, then yeah, absolutely. Let's infiltrate some of their, you know, patterns of play and some of their game models onto what we currently do. But I think that, you know, if we end up just reacting to things all the time, then there can potentially be a lack of clarity, whether it's with the coaches or the players, about how we play. And I think that the best clubs in academy football, women's football, have just got a really strong identity. And it might change, it might alter depending on the opposition or the context of the game. But generally, there's a set of principles that when we've got the ball, this is what we're going to do. When we haven't got the ball, this is what we're going to do. And, you know, that could be flexible, whether there's a back three, back four, back five. But it's generally how we're going to play. And then absolutely, there'll inevitably be things that come up where you see a team doing the principles of play that we believe in brilliantly. And then let's really learn what they're doing, how they're doing it, what's the detail. And then potentially, you know, from a periodisation perspective, what does that look like in our training? And rather than being dictated to and reacting to some of these, things and evidence that we're seeing in World Cups and big tournaments, just stick to what we're good at and be confident that that's going to work and have some belief that that's the right thing to do.
Yeah, because you look at the, I get it off topic a little bit, but you see there's a lot of players these days that are part-time players, you know, and you probably had to work with a lot of part-time players. But the biggest thing is that there's nutrition, you know. You've got nutrition, you've got, obviously, we talk about the physiology, you know, men's and women's football, the, again, 11v11, you know, it is, just need to just adapt, but also make it specific to what's needed, you know, from the nutritional, from the menstrual cycle to everything. And it's I listened to Emma Hayes, and she's really interesting, and she talked about, obviously, the different parts, and she's got a lot of resources, she says. But the biggest thing is, from a technical director's point of view, and when you're a head coach, you're obviously working part-time players. How did you try and make these players that 1% better? Because we have to understand that some of these players will work from 8 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock at night, or 6 o'clock at night, and they're coming in to train, and they might be exhausted. How do you try and tailor that session, but also help them with nutrition, with ideas on... Maybe they can't make training, but you give them something to work on because they still are part of the project. I think it's just a lot of coaches really struggle with the adaption of this when they treat the men's game as the reference to the women's game, when the women's game is still a game of football, but you have to adapt it like you would adapt to the men's game. You know, like again, you look at ACL injuries is the biggest thing in the women's game. But hamstring problems are happening in the men's game too. But there's a lot more research. But now there's a lot more research going on with ACL, menstrual cycle, and how it works. Is that something you had to work on, you know, from a male point of view, you know, from when you're working in it? And also, the next part is, do you see when you're working in staff, you brought staff in, do you try and bring female staff in so there's a bit more of a, they can rely on them because they might be a bit more normalised, you know, when they talk about these things, because it's a taboo, but it's actually a big subject which needs to be addressed, but normalised. If you normalise it, then people will feel better talking about it, and therefore there's a more of a trust on the head coach and the people around you.
I think if I'm speaking about areas that I could have been better at during my time at West Bromwich Albion, I think that I was always actively listening to players for the first two or three years of my time there. But as my role started to grow and become more time consuming off the pitch in administration and finance and strategy, budgeting, stuff like that, I probably didn't spend enough time speaking to the players about what they needed and what they wanted. And I'm able to obviously reflect on that now that I've got a bit more time. When I did have conversations with the players, it was always extremely useful, because as a male in the female game, you can kind of fall into the trap of presuming that your ideas are going to be excellent and we can just execute them and we'll be better for it. But actually, you need to continuously have dialogue with the players around what they think, you know, their perceptions, their potential challenges, their worries about, you know, things that we might potentially be looking to try as a club. I was very fortunate in the last year of working at West Brom that I had a head coach that did that job for me particularly well. So she was always the person that would connect me to the players through senior leadership meetings with the players that would then be relayed onto myself. The next challenge for me was almost then looking at the resources that were available to us, the budgets that were available to us, to try and make some of this stuff happen. So, you know, one area that we got particularly, you know, a large amount of media attention was around changing our shorts from white shorts to navy shorts in order to help the players and feel more comfortable and so on, for obvious reasons. And that came about through dialogue, you know, from player to head coach into myself. And then obviously that decision was ratified by the powers that be. So I think, you know, it's naive to come up with ideas and just, you know, do them in isolation and presume that they're going to be, you know, mind-blowing decisions that change the course of time for our football club. You need to have that conversation and you know, the check-ins with the players to make sure it works. Something that we did always try and do was, you know, give the players a voice in terms of, for example, who the first team head coach would be. So rather than, you know, me making that decision, potentially with a couple of other people to shortlist and maybe the chairman, we would always speak to the players about what they think they wanted and, you know, what as a club do we need? And we would always try and then look at that alignment between what players need, what I needed as a TD, and then what the club needed. And inevitably, what would come out was that we were always on the same page, which was great. And that showed that there was obviously a bit of a culture at the club around knowing what we wanted and understanding expectations. So yeah, it's a real challenge, but I think that open, you know, dialogue showcases to people that there is a growth mindset around the club, that we want to get better, and the players are an integral part of that. As I say, I wish I'd had a little bit more time to interact with the players in certainly last season, but fortunately, as I say, we had good people around us. I suppose just the final point there about the staffing is we were always very mindful of having a diverse staffing group. I'm not a person to particularly try and bullseye a female head coach or to bullseye a male head coach. It's very much who's going to be the right person for this job right now. And then hopefully we obviously find that person and they're willing to come in and work with us. But it was always around diversity. Like, something that we check and challenge all the time is, you know, do we have diverse opinions within the staffing group? Have we got enough females, enough males? You know, have we got enough role models? Personalities, I think, are really important. You know, if you've got a group of introverts, then you get great creativity, but you maybe sometimes lack some dynamism in the changing room. you know, but again, too many extroverts, and that again comes with problems, and so we'd always look at that diversity. Have we got the right people on the right seats of the bus? And most of the time we did have that, and I've been very fortunate to work with some outstanding minds over the course of the last few years.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because we talk about the staff recruitment. You need to always have working with budgets, you need to work with players, you need to work with full-time staff and part-time staff. What was the biggest challenge being a technical director, but also do you think it was an advantage being a head coach first and then stepping up? And did you have like a mentor or someone you kind of spoke with beforehand? Because the TD role or sport director is probably one of the biggest jobs in football, but a lot of people get it right and a lot of people get it wrong. But the advice I've always given is, if you want to be a TD, always try and be maybe a head coach or a sports scientist or something that you know that you're in football already, but you can aspire to be. Is that something that you try to, you know, work on when you were as a head coach? Did you try and step up, you know, up to the TD, or was it always an ambition to go to the top level?
Yeah, I think that the TD position is certainly one that I enjoyed. It's one that I'm on the lookout for now in my next move. I certainly see myself as having some competencies and skills in that area that would be useful for players and coaches. So, yeah, I enjoyed it massively. I think in terms of the challenges would be, you know, dealing with footballers, and that is a brilliant part of the game, and it's a really enjoyable part. But then it's also a challenge in terms of, you know, expectation. I think it's something that's happening massively in the women's game now, and we need to be very mindful of, you know, being transparent in terms of what we can do and what we can't do, and we have to live to our means as a football club in terms of the resources. But at the same time, there's some really good stuff happening in women's football, and we wanted to be at the forefront of that in even in tier three. So, yeah, challenges always present opportunities. You know, the opportunities then came around, well, how can we be innovative, and how can we get this stuff for the players, and how can we meet their expectations, but doing it in a way which maybe isn't just as easy as throwing money at it. So, you know, that work from the RTC all the way up to the women's first team is trying to be creative and create outstanding experiences for them, as players and as staff within limited resources. I think in terms of my sounding boards, if you like, and my mentors, I was always, you know, a real believer in informal learning opportunities, and I take CPD very seriously. As an FA coach mentor myself, I was always very aware of the benefits of having somebody to bounce ideas with, and you know, play devil's advocate. I would really love conversations with people that would not just agree with me, and that would challenge some of my ideas and suggestions. And sometimes I'd go away with my tail between my legs, you know, thinking, oh, this is a brilliant idea. This is going to change the world. And then 10 minutes after speaking to somebody, they play devil's advocate almost too much, and they completely pop your balloon. So there was some of those conversations that looking back on it now were quite useful. Again, just because it was my idea doesn't necessarily mean it was a good idea. And sometimes you need to be vulnerable with that. I think there's an element of mentorship where, you know, you can have a really nice, lovely conversation, or you can get critical feedback that might potentially be upsetting, but actually it's really useful and really helps you in your role or your decision or your task at hand. And again, like, you know, I was very fortunate to have such people around me, whether it would be the head coach, whether it be, you know, RTC coaches, friends, chairman. You know, one of the first things that we did when we knew that we wanted to move the women's team into the men's club was to devise an advisory board and a group of strategic minds that were able to help me and be sounding boards to me and some of the things that I was looking to try and do. And again, retrospectively, did we use them enough? Probably not. I think that they were there and they were very much kind of, you know, if we wanted to use them, then they would be there and always on the end of the phone. But, you know, we probably could have been a little bit more, you know, connected to that degree. So I think certainly it's an important factor, is having, you know, that circle of genius around you to challenge or to, you know, just give you another perception that might potentially give you, you know, more intelligence around your around the decisions that you're about to make. And probably in that way, it allows you to avoid mistakes as much as maybe they might happen. So, yeah, certainly really key. The TD role was surrounded with great people, as I say, you know, and whether it was a volunteer, 16 years of age, that would give me a perspective that I hadn't even thought of before, because they're more connected to the kids than myself as a 39-year-old, you know, who better to speak to about modern day football for a 16-year-old than a 16-year-old, right? So they became really good sounding boards, and again, just a key skill for anybody in my position would be, as I say, being vulnerable enough to go and approach those people. Forget hierarchy, forget who should be giving you advice. Just go and speak to loads of people about, you know, the issues or concerns or opportunities that you might have, and then you've got some really good critical analysis around what you're hoping to do and whether to actually do it or not. And, you know, most of the time it can be a real time saver in terms of thinking, well, actually, this isn't going to work. The players aren't going to like it, so I'm not going to do it. I'm going to focus on something else.
Yeah. And when you look at, like the commercial side, the recruitment side, but also the biggest thing you see now is everyone's networking. And it's a huge, if you network well, you basically win a lot of parts of the game. But the biggest thing is some people are afraid to chat the door or ask questions. And I'm not afraid. I think I've got, like, I send multiple emails or multiple messages to different people, and I kid you not, I probably get quite a good response now, because it's your reputation. I think it was like, you can build your reputation in 20 years and lose it in 20 seconds, you know. It's really, but you need to be asking questions. But also, the thing is, I always remember someone said to me, ask a question, listen to the answer, but also challenge the answer in a way that you're going to get more out of the person. But, like, a lot of my mentors, when I go to conferences, go in the front row, ask questions, because you might not get that opportunity ever again. So ask questions. Like, I think I asked a question last year at the Soccer Science event, and it was about payments, you know, like, and how the, on the kind of individual, like, coaches, you know, like sports scientists and all, how they, I think it was because there was a job advert, and it was like between this amount, and I'm like, well, that's not really, how's that, that's not livable, you know what I mean? But it was more of a, how does a person who's on a good wage at the highest level, but they're actually, see the ones who are taking the 12s and the 14s or the 10s, they should be potentially getting a similar wage because they're developing the next generation. But again, it was actually caused a bit of a debate, which I really didn't want it to happen. But I do some mock interviews, you know, to obviously with my game model and, you know, presenting ideas to the clubs. See, when you bring in coaches in, a head coach or maybe a coach that or a sports scientist, do you, as a TD, obviously, do you have two or three people around you to make decisions, or do you sometimes have people who are not related to the club from an outside point of view make a decision, because therefore they can make a decision on the person? Because if you're a TD, you can probably see it from a football point of view, but if it's a person from outside the club, completely like a person you trust, is that something that you've kind of done before, or what? I'm just looking for maybe some advice on some of the coaches might want to know about interviews. You know, how do you interview for a head coach's job when you do have the experience, you do have the knowledge, but you might struggle putting that together, you know, for, you know, a presentation?
Yeah, you're absolutely right about asking questions. I think certainly something that I've hoped, I certainly hope that I've improved upon it over the last 4 or 5 years, is that ability to be an active listener and almost seek first to understand. During COVID, I spent some time just trying to, I just got bored during COVID doing session plans and learning about football. Everything was football, right? So you'd watch FA Education online. They've got some brilliant resources. But after sitting on your bike for an hour every morning and watching all of the, you start to get a little bit like Groundhog Day. So I just thought, I'll just try and learn some different stuff. And I actually got really into and interested into Greek philosophy and Greek mythology, which is a crazy world, and I often try and connect what I'm learning to football and football coaching. There's no way that you can connect Greek mythology to football, so I'm not even going to try and suggest that there's a link between those two. But Greek philosophy really was interesting to me, and Socrates, the way that he developed knowledge was through asking questions, and as such he became somebody that was renowned for being intelligent, one of the most intelligent humans to have ever lived, if you listen to a lot of people that would write about Greek philosophy. So yeah, certainly seek first to understand, asking lots of questions, and delving into detail, not just being happy with a superficial suggestion around, well, this is the way that we do things at this football club. And it needs to be that not interrogation, but certainly a dialogue around, well, why do you do it that way? What else have you tried? Like, how do you know it works? As I say, sometimes the dynamic of that conversation in a hierarchy can be quite difficult. So, sometimes I might say to a coach, why are you doing that? And because of the way that they've been spoken to in the past, and maybe something more societal around somebody in a managerial position asking why, that can be seen as an aggressive, don't do that, why are you doing that at our club? But genuinely, and this is something I would speak to the coaches about, I'm interested. You might be right. You might have stumbled across something that is brilliant and I really like it. So, it would happen a lot with the strength and conditioning coaches. I'd say, why are you getting the players to jump over that way? Why are they stretching at that point? Why are they sprinting to the left when most movements involve sprinting forwards, or, whatever it might be? There's just that interrogation and asking why. And, that, I think, hopefully that showed that I had a growth mindset to try and understand more about areas that I'm not ever going to profess to be an expert within, like the physical side. And I'd have some brilliant conversations with our psychology coach. He was a volunteer, but he was outstanding. He just did some brilliant workshops with the players, and we just have some great chats about how he's improving the players in terms of their resilience. How can you turn a 15-year-old female football player who has got the world on her shoulders, schools, relationships, parents, and football thrown in, like, how do you convince her that she's a good football player and she could play for the Lionesses when, she just thinks that every time that she touches the ball, she's going to give it away? Like, what do we do? How can we help? And, it created quite a vibrant environment of questions, and it's okay to ask questions, and don't feel threatened when you are asked the question. It's an attempt for everybody to try and understand and improve their knowledge. So, as much as I did have people that I could turn to offer, that external voice and external support, we also had some brilliant people in the building that were able to offer that. Your point about networking is quite topical for me at the moment. I'm reflecting on the last 18 years at West Bromwich Albion. I used to hate networking. I really, when there was a networking event, or you'd go to an event or a conference and it had that 15-minute slot that just said network, I would dread that moment. I would just think, right, just find the coffee machine, pretend to be on the phone and just try and swerve that bit, because I was never confident enough or, so I suppose socially competent enough to just go and approach people and just, just network and be around. Oh, you're so-and-so from that club. You're doing some great stuff. That was never me. But I'm starting to realise now that that is such an important factor of coaching, but also, career development. The game is certainly, very important what you know. You need to have good knowledge. You need to know your stuff. You need to be content rich in terms of what you're going to be producing for people in terms of, tasks, documentation, player development plans, strategies. But, the voices inside those buildings are vastly important as well. And if somebody knows you and knows that you do a good job and, you've got a good reputation around you and you can be trusted as a member of staff, then that's a massive tick in the box, and something that people should never underestimate. Certainly, as I say, I was poor at networking. I wish it was better, because maybe my search for employment currently could be a little bit smoother if I took that more seriously. So yeah, certainly that's a lesson learned around just you know, I suppose getting out of your comfort zone of just being around the people that you know, and actually being that person at the front of a course and asking the questions and taking phone numbers of people that you've had an interesting conversation with. And you know, social media is great for it. You can follow people on Twitter and see what they're talking about and see what they're tweeting. But, you know, reach out to them. You know, every 2 or 3 days, I had some brilliant advice last week from a mentor of mine, actually, who's got a head of coaching position, doing really well. And he just said, just reach out to people in your network. Make sure there's 2 a day and just phone them. Don't just text them. Just phone them and, like, what's going on? What do you know? What's happening? Anything I should be aware of? Like, you know, what's your learning looking like at the moment? And it really challenges you and gets you out of your comfort zone. And initially when he said it, I was like, kind of just WhatsApp him. You know, it's much easier. And then you avoid that awkward silence that might potentially happen on the phone. But, you know, just give them a call, two a day. And it's, you know, been a really interesting time as a result of it. And what you tend to find actually is that conversation then spirals into something else.
Aye.
And, you know, that potentially lands itself then on some really cool stuff.
No, tell me about it. I think actually there's a couple of things for that. Like people who I phone people, you know, and then it's 7 hours later. Oh, sorry, I was busy. And I'm thinking, right, no, you were busy. You just see my number and just decided, nah, I can't afford talking to this Scottish guy for an hour. But you told me networking is really interesting because I was at an event, must have been 4 or 5 years ago, and it was in Barcelona. And I could speak okay Spanish, I can get by. But what I did is I asked the question in Spanish to the guy who was in head of methodology for a company. And he answered me back in Spanish, and it was a two-way conversation because I could understand what he was. Okay, it was quite slow, but he understood it. See, the end, obviously, I was packing my bags up, and they said to me, "Let's go for a drink," and I went out with him, and we must have talked about for a good 2 hours. He speaks good English, and I could understand his Spanish, so we kind of got a lot about by. But he says nobody else had the, you know, basically to speak to me about things. It was a very generic questions, and you put a really specific question. And see, the thing is, people look at you like you've got 3 heads when you try and show off. I wasn't trying to show off. It was more of a, I'm going out of my comfort zone, and people recognise that. You know, like I send messages through LinkedIn. I also send messages in Spanish. I can understand a little bit of Portuguese. I can speak a little bit of French. But people reply to me in Spanish, and it's a two-way conversation. 9 to 10 times, I'll probably get the grammar wrong, but the, at least people who are trying. And you get so many invites to different events, so many invites to clubs. You know, like I spoke to a guy in America yesterday, and he basically said, we talked for an hour on the phone, he's a good friend, but he said, "Oh, hey, come over and I'll show you around for the week." You know what I mean? And it's that way, it's just that, because it's not about, it's your reputation at the end of the day. But if you're not afraid to put yourself out there, and then I think that's the biggest thing in women's football. A lot of women, I was reading Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg, the ex, I think it was one of the big directors at Facebook, but she says a lot of it is women really, really struggle to go out there and network because they feel they're going to get rejected. Like a man actually was out there, they'll feel threatened if there's a rejection. And how do you think women's football has improved over the last few while? What do you think needs to be improved? But also from a head coach's point of view, how important is technique in the kind of the women's game, and what else do you think is kind of needed when you're developing a kind of curriculum for kind of the senior kind of academy or the senior players, the first team players?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time kind of thinking about those things, I suppose, when I went back into the role of head of women's and girls football. And I'd just done 4 years at West Bromwich Albion's academy that at the time was just outstanding, producing some players that are playing in the Premier League now. They're doing brilliant stuff. So their productivity has always been excellent. At that time, it was certainly at its pomp. And I kind of utilised some of the methodologies and structures and even DNA practices, drills and things that they were doing in the boys' academy, and just kind of analyse whether it would be something that we can move across into the women's team. And again, just not just copying something and almost, you know, just moving it across and presuming that it was going to work in a female game was important. We needed to to deep dive into, is it going to work? Do the players like it? And is it right for us as a women's club just because the boys do it? So, you know, that analysis of would it work and having, you know, key people around me to guide me down that route, I think was always important. I think technique in the women's game is improving massively, and we've got to give credit to the coaches that are very intentional. You know, you've got coaches that are now not just seeing women's football as a plan B. I think, you know, 10 years ago it was a case of male coaches wanting to get into the male game and the male academy, and if they didn't quite get in, then I'll go into the women's game. You see male and female coaches now that really want to go and be effective in the women's game and understand that they need to adapt some sessions and adapt behaviours to suit the needs of the female game. But what you then end up with is really good, strong coaches that can teach techniques, whether that's in one-to-one sessions, you know, unit practices. And so we've got to give a lot of credit to them for wanting to be in that space. And, you know, the FA are doing some great stuff, not just in terms of the women's game, but educating coaches generally. You know, I'm fortunate enough to, in my previous life, travel across to, you know, Africa and Asia and Canada and different places. Our education system that the FA are able to provide is second to none. Like, it's outstanding. The resources online, the courses, the course tutors themselves. Finishing my UA for A license, I can sit back now and look at it. That was an unbelievable experience. You know, the information I got, the technical detail that challenged me. You know, watching games back, watching players within the games, you know, under the microscope, as they say, was a real insight into how detailed we need to be. And it was definitely a rocket for me to think, actually, I know a lot of stuff, but I've got to know more. You know, if I want to be, you know, a technical director of a WSL club or whatever else, I need to up my game, because some of these coaches that are now working are unbelievable. You know, you've got 19, 20 year olds that are like attempting to get onto their A license, and they're coaching elite players 20 hours a week. They've got some great knowledge and some really good insight. So, you know, you're almost forced into a position where you've got to keep upskilling yourself, and that can only be good for the players. You know, I think video analysis creeping into the game helps technical development as well. And, you know, the ability to watch yourself back and you know, slow things down, quicken things up, you know, watch a 3-minute video of yourself, but in those 3 minutes you see every single touch within a 90-minute game, how successful you were. And, you know, even better if would be you've got somebody at your club that can potentially talk you through some of that stuff and what have they noticed technically. So it's definitely more apparent in the women's game now that technical development is important. I think the one area that has just improved massively is the physical space. I think you've got female footballers now that are absolute athletes. You know, again, 10 years ago when I was managing in the women's game, you'd have players that were technically very good and physically they were okay, but you knew for a fact 10 minutes before the end of the game it would look completely different. The game would be stretched, you know, tiredness, fatigue would kick in. You know, the game became a bit of a scrap because physically the players couldn't control the way that the game was paced. But now you've just got, as I say, athletes. The nutrition stuff that you mentioned earlier plays a really big part into that. And women's football is becoming, you know, professional, full-time. You know, there's a lot of clubs, even in Tier 3, that are suggesting they've got hybrid models. So they've got training 3 or 4 times a week and they're really upping the ante in that space. So, you know, it's definitely improving. My concerns would be just around brilliant resources that are going into the clubs. I feel like the clubs now need people that understand how to use those resources, how to use the finances properly, and making sure that there's a complete alignment. So the women's football club knows what to expect from the men's side of the club. You know, we often talk about the club, but there's certainly, you know, still a kind of difference between the women's side and the men's side in most football clubs. And it's just clear and concise information to the women's team about what the men's club feel about them. And, you know, that really helps them with expectation around what we can expect from the men's club in terms of support. I think that's a vital piece of work in all of the clubs, is making sure that you know, there's transparency from the men's club to say, this is what we want from you as a women's section. We want you to win the league. We want you to play in the championship. We want you to be in WSL. Like that, those statements are so important because it gives you complete clarity. It's up to you then to decide for whether you're ready for that challenge and whether you feel like you can do that job. Or is it just the case of, you know, we like you and we want to have a women's team, but it's going to be limited in terms of the resources that we're able to provide. And again, that expectation then is lower, but at least everybody knows how things are going to be working and the expectation that's on the women's team. So certainly, you know, more resources going into it is vital. It's then, you know, all this cultural stuff, all the more strategic stuff that I think that is hugely important. And, you know, some people might not like what they hear. You know, everyone wants to try and be told that they're going to push for the WSL. But, you know, in reality, that's going to be very difficult. You know, I'm looking at Tier 3 in the Northern Premier League. 7 teams could potentially win that division, in my opinion. And it's going to be really difficult for all of those players to buy into what we're going to win the league. So people need to be very careful about, you know, how they pitch their ambitions. And I'm sure that is something that's happening in the clubs because, as I say, there's some very, very talented coaches and managers in each of the clubs that I'm mentioning. So, yeah, it's in a brilliant, really interesting time. Like, what's happening in women's football is really interesting. And, you know, maybe, depending on my next job, I'll have an opportunity to watch it from the outside. And that would just be really interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, and got 2 more questions. You talk about resourcefulness, you know, like I love learning, I love, you know, listening to podcasts, reading, even speaking to other coaches is great. But how do you improve your CPD? How do you make yourself that little bit better every day? Because as you said, during COVID, it was the same thing every day. You're trying to put so much theory, but you can't do any of the practical, and you can't do any practical if you don't do any theory. But the thing is, I've learned sometimes you need to just take having a break for a couple of months actually makes you more energised, but also you can have more time to spend it with family, you spend time with learning, but also just, you know what, sometimes you just want to sit back and go, I don't want to do nothing for a couple of hours, and actually do that sometimes is the best CPD sometimes, but also a lot of people just can't turn off either, which is really one of the biggest things that we as coaches really struggle with. But how do you improve your CPD?
Really important to detach yourself from football, I think, because, you know, we often feel that we need to be obsessed with football in order to progress. You know, I think that some people have been obsessed and have done particularly well and are now earning, you know, good money and, you know, they've got good careers in the game. Me personally, I think it's more important to have a more strategic approach. So, you know, again, going through COVID, I got really annoyed at myself if I didn't listen to a podcast every day. Mm. But now I'm like, well, if I don't listen to a podcast, it's fine. I just need to make sure that the next podcast I listen to is really relevant. Rather than listening to 100 podcasts in a month, I might only have time now to only listen to 3 or 4. So rather than just downloading everything that might be relevant, I'm now looking at, you know, what's specific to me in my current situation right now. So, you know, I'm listening to more stuff now around leadership, you know, cultural development, that kind of thing. The coaching stuff I love, I really enjoy. And you know, when time allows, I'll listen to some of that stuff and read some of those books. But certainly it's about, you know, having an objective in mind in terms of where I need to go to and where I want to go to. And then, you know, your CPD kind of revolves around that. You know, having just informal conversations with people is vital. Making the most of those conversations is even more vital. So, you know, I was at a soccer camp today. I went down to observe, you know, a soccer camp, grassroots, recreational. But as I'm driving in, I'm thinking, right, today, can I learn something that I never knew? So that growth mindset around, you know, I might potentially be the most senior person at that soccer camp. I've been asked to go in there and observe and give some pointers to coaches and so on, but there's probably going to be something that I could learn from a player or from a coach and being open to that and almost going looking for it. What then starts to happen with my CPD is I've become curious about something. Joe, you know, a coach might speak to me today about, you know, finishing drills. And then I start thinking, well, you know, that's made me a bit curious. I need to maybe go away and look at more practice design options. I maybe need to start thinking about, you know, realistic finishing practices that I can maybe put into one-to-one sessions that I deliver. So, yeah, CPD, I mean, formal CPD for me at the moment is I'm quite happy with where I'm at. Like, I feel like my formal CPD is in a good place. So it's now about just maximizing the experiences, listening to things, reading things that are super relevant for right now, but also just being comfortable. If I don't do anything during the space of a week, it's not the be all and end all. You know, maybe I've just decided to spend a bit more time with my family and jump off the hamster wheel a little bit, because, you know, I've now got the gift of time to reflect, and certainly something that I do need to do more when I go into my next role is be where my feet are. And if I'm with my family, you know, I'm with my family. I'm not thinking about doing a session plan or getting on the phone to speak to that coach about something that happened yesterday. You know, I'm detaching myself and then presenting myself with opportunities to learn at other stages during the week.
Yeah. And final question we asked the guests is what does mindset mean to you?
Yes, I saw when you sent across the meeting notes, I saw this question, and this is the one probably that I've given the most amount of thought to, but it's probably the one that I can be the briefest within. I think mindset is a thought, and the people with the best mindset are the ones that are able to think about their thoughts, and then that transpires into effective behaviours. So when we often think about mindset, we think about focus, we think about concentration and an attitude towards something that we deem to be important. I think then the important part is connecting mindset to your behaviours. So your mindset might be around focus and hard work. That then needs to transpire in behaviours. And ideally, those behaviours then become consistent. If there's a gap in any of that, then you may not potentially reach your objectives. But if you've got an outstanding mindset and you think about thinking, connect that to your behaviours, and then it becomes consistent. I think everyone, you know, that is able to do that has got a chance to reach and fulfil their potential.
Oh, brilliant. A good hour. Thank you again, Dave.
No problem at all. Thank you.